And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to episode 115 of the Keith Law Show. My guest today is Eric Longenhagen, prospect expert and writer for Fangraphs, who just posted his top 100 prospects for 2023 over on that site. I encourage you all to check it out. We're going to walk through players where we differ quite a bit in our rankings between my top 100, which dropped a couple of weeks ago for subscribers to The Athletic, and his. And we'll do a little draft chat at the very end of our conversation as well. In the meantime, the most recent thing I've posted for subscribers to The Athletic was my ranking of the top 20 prospects for impact specifically in 2023, which is obviously a very different list than my top 100 and is tied a lot more to playing time than it is to long-term expectations, which is how I do the top 100. I also did have a draft blog post from before that where I was in Arlington, Texas at Globe Life Field for a 16 college tournament this last weekend that included at least two first rounders or probable first rounders in TCU third baseman Braden Taylor and Vanderbilt outfielder Enrique Bradfield Jr., both of whom Eric and I discuss at the end of our conversation. For those of you who also follow me for board game content, my most recent review for Pace Magazine, which went up actually on Valentine's Day, was Quacks and Company, which is the kids' version of the game The Quacks of Quedlinburg. If you haven't heard of The Quacks of Quedlinburg, despite the awkward name, it's a fantastic game and a game that I really like for family play. I think kids 8 and up can handle it pretty easily. But that also you could just play with adults and be totally fine. It's fun enough. It's got push your luck elements. It is there's a lot of simultaneous play, so it tends to move very quickly. Quacks and Company is a good kids version, but my experience is that there's kind of a narrow window for players to play that. If you're old enough to play that, you are almost old enough to play the full version of the game. So as much as I like Quacks and Company for what it is, I think you'll find the review is probably a little bit mixed on sort of, hey, if you like the adult version, do you really need this one? I'm not sure the answer to that. Now I'm excited to bring back my first ever guest from the Keith Law Show. We sort of do this every year, I think. It's Eric Longenhagen, if you don't remember. He does kind of what I do, except he does it for Fangraphs instead of doing it for The Athletic. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, if you don't remember, amid all the academics and screenwriters and like important people that Keith has on, that the Fangraphs prospect guy was the first one on the podcast. Like, I don't know what you're doing. Do you even care about Keith if you don't know that?
Is that the guy with the hair and the Magic definitely, the Gathering? Yeah, that's him. That is actually Eric. Yes.
Man, the people who saw me at the pool this week definitely know I'm the guy with the hair.
With the hair. I'll have to figure out what games I'm bringing for my spring training trip for us to try this year.
All right, then you got to let me, you know, have another run at showing you Magic. It's so hard to – Magic's tough because the rules are so dense that it takes forever to just be fluent with them and then play the game.
Right. Yeah, which is actually true of a lot of games. I mean, not all games I play, but there are a lot of games I play where it's like the second time you think, okay, now I know what I'm doing. Now I get it. Now I know what the cards are or what – action is more powerful. There's a game called Gizmos that I've probably played, I don't know, 50 times between in person and online. And it was like 15 or 20 before I realized, oh, this one thing I'm supposed to do is just better. That one action, one type of card is just better. Not a ton better, but better enough that I need to do that more. And then suddenly I started doing better. Not great. Still not great at that game, but I like it. But it was just, I had to play it a bunch of times to see different things play out. What do other people do? And, oh, I try this and it just doesn't work. Fails miserably. Okay, do this instead. And, you know, I think that's true of a lot of games. Doesn't make it a bad game, but it means you can't just drop somebody in and expect them to be good at it.
No doubt. Yeah. And I love seeing the way people's, especially like other prospect writers, how the things that make them good at or seem to draw them toward baseball prospects bleeding into the other parts of their life. So like you and I are pattern recognition guys where it's like, oh, I guess I should play a bird on the first turn to like start the engine.
Right. Right. Yes.
And it took me like a couple games to realize that.
Yeah. That's the way to, right. You've got to start something to get going.
Yeah, you have to make an adjustment.
Yep. Exactly. Well, let's talk prospects. We could talk games the whole time. And I think some of our listeners would like that. But you dropped your top 100 prospects the day before we're recording this. I dropped mine a couple of weeks ago. And as always, you know, I love looking at your list because it's like, where do we differ? Like, we tend to think about players very much similarly. We have access to, I think, a lot of the same information. But we talk to different people and we see the players and we think differently about them. So I wanted to highlight some situations where some particular players where we widely diverged in either direction and just see where our differences are. So one I'll start with, we're not wildly different on Jackson Merrill. You had him at 10th on your list. He was 20th on mine. And I like Jackson Merrill a lot. And I thought I was being reasonably aggressive, but you're all in. And what is there anything in particular in the skill set that makes you, I would say this is probably just more confidence. We probably think the same thing about his ceiling, but you're more confident that he gets there.
I guess so. Yeah. I think the hit tool specifically there, watching him for 6 weeks in fall league, it was a different, it's a luxury look to get that long and to have this degree of confidence in like what I think is the driving tool here. I made the Michael Brantley at shortstop comp in the blurb. And that is sort of where I think this is headed. I talked to a bunch of people who face Jackson Merrill a lot, like people from other non-Padre orgs who end up facing their affiliates and go in there to see their guys against the Padres. And this is someone who they can't get out. This is someone who doesn't really have a hole in the zone. There's nowhere to beat this guy. And I came away from fall league confident that was true. So I valued him enough ahead of some of the other up the middle guys in that like 15 to 40 area, which is, you know, about where you have him. Like, you know, if you have a guy at 20, he's basically 32. Like at that point, the players are starting to clump a little bit. And so, you know, the other guys who were in that mix, like on the line where my 60s transition into 55s, just didn't feel quite as good about everybody else's bat to ball skill as I did Merrill. And that's just what I care the most about.
Okay. Yeah. That makes a ton of sense to me. I mean, I love the hit tool. I absolutely agree. He's a shortstop. He got a lot stronger after. I should have prefaced this. He is a Padres shortstop prospect. He is their number one prospect. He was also their first round pick in 2021. And when he came back in the spring of 22, I don't know if you saw him after he signed in 21, but when he came back in 22, almost immediately I was getting texts from buddies who was like, you should see what Jackson Merrill looks like. He jacked up that offseason. And suddenly it was, oh, this guy's contact quality is probably going to be a lot better. And it was. And he was a more advanced hitter, I think, than most folks saw. Because I live in the area where, you know, lots of area, I know lots of area scouts here. And I didn't know a single one who thought he was this soon. Now, that doesn't affect where I rank him now, but it does affect what I said at the time of the draft. And then all of a sudden this year, it's, whoa,
sure,
we were all light on this guy, particularly as a hitter. And I don't know that it's going to be big power. I like the Brantley comp, right? That was a ton of doubles and triples. Brantley was younger and he could run. There were years where he was, you know, MVP-ish, not an MVP, but somebody, if he was 10th or 9th on your ballot, yeah, actually, he's that good of a player. You put that guy at shortstop, he probably is an MVP candidate in some years and justifies being in the top 10.
Yeah, some of it is, and like, you know, Merrill was the 27th pick in his draft and he signed an underslot deal. I had him, I think, 70th or close to that on my draft board. You know, as a high school shortstop in Florida, and those guys don't tend to make their way out to the SoCal Arizona showcase stuff that I frequent. You know, I miss a lot of the Southeast guys until later, when you like you have to go in and see them. And then, but yeah, at this stage, this is I think the best guy from the 2021 draft. Like, I'm more confident in the bat to ball here than with Marcelo Meyer, who I do think will have more power, and a little bit more confident despite the injuries that like Jackson Merrill is actually a shortstop relative to like Marcelo. So yeah, like I think at this stage, looking back, like this was the Padres do know how to pick them. Some of the stuff that they do feels like unsustainable, and just the way that they're willing to cycle through these guys to build this top heavy roster, which is incredible. But also they are pretty good at pointing at players and being like, you're really good, aren't you? And they're right a lot of the time.
Yeah, you also have him over Jordan Lawler, who had a pretty impressive debut and pretty impressive. I was very impressed by him in Fall League. I like all three of these guys. So do you. These are fine. Just for listeners who are, these are fine distinctions, right? All three of these guys are in both of our top 20s. Actually, I think they're all in your top 18 and they're all in my top 20. So let me transition to the guy you have at number 20, which was one of our biggest differences. I thought I was sort of aggressive on Red Sox prospect Miguel Blais just by having him at 72 on my list, where you know, we haven't seen him a lot. And there's definitely some swing and miss, but there's huge upside. You put him 20th. So you're taking a stand on this guy. I'm not saying you're wrong in any possible way, but what is it that made you sort of say, we all do this. We plant a flag, whether we intend to or not. You are simply saying you like this guy a ton and you believe that he's got at least more probability. So great. What is it that you see here that makes you more of a believer that he's going to get there, get to some kind of ceiling?
Yeah, this is the type of guy who he's come up a lot discussing things with people, obviously, because it does seem like I was ultra aggressive with this guy. The things that made me confident to do it, obviously, there's a little bit of an approach difference between you and I with players like this in general. When you and I were working together, at some point I sent you video, cell phone video of Alexander Canario swinging a bat, just, you know, in a complex game for the Giants. And I was like, you know, this guy's 18. You see him swinging like this. Do you need to know anything else about this guy before you think like he's definitely a first round talent? And a lot of the time with it, you know, you said no, like you wanted to know a lot more about that guy. And I am way more likely to just go, I just got done seeing all these 17, 18 year old guys do showcase stuff in high school. Now it's instructional league time in the fall. And some of the same age type of players are coming up from the DSL. If a guy like Miguel Blais is taking BP, it looks like the best handful of 17, 18 year old draft guys who I just got done watching. So that's part of what gives me the confidence to look at the recent top three, top five high school draft picks and apples to apples Miguel Blais with them. Even though I didn't know, you know, Miguel Blais didn't have a commitment. We don't have like 2 years of him playing East Coast Pro and area code and perfect game events on tape. Like there are all kinds of other reasons that there's like a delta to the confidence interval between a guy like Termar Johnson and a guy like Miguel Blais. But then let's dig into the data, because this is just a guy who you look at him and he lights you up with the bat speed and like how much room for strength he still has and all that stuff. So the data, surface level stats terrified me. And so at some point during the early part of the process, because this is like a 6% walk rate guy. And so that's scary.
And like a 27 or 28% strikeout rate guy in the complex.
Right. Yeah. It was in the mid 20s somewhere.
Yeah.
Which on the complex again is sort of like, yeah, that's a yellow flag probably.
Yeah, that's fair.
I don't kill guys for that.
I have guys on we both have guys on our list with strikeout rates, and we're going to talk about another one too with strikeout rates who are higher than you want them to be. So it's just another variable we consider.
Miguel Blais's barrel rate is like, it almost breaks the 20-80 scale when you adjust it for his age. It is on par with like quad A guys like Jake Cave and just physically mature guys. The quality of his contact is up there with these types of guys who are like, it's well above the major league average, certainly in center field right now, like as Miguel Blais is a teenager. And then his chase and contact stuff, which is more granular, like it's a little bit more specific and telling, than just the walk rate and the strikeout rate. That stuff was better, especially like his chase rates are actually closer to average. So he's at the very least swinging at strikes. He wasn't walking a lot, but he is swinging at strikes. And so that was enough for me. It separated him from the group of guys who were initially in like my 70 to 80 range, these high variance, high upside guys, the junior Caminero's of the world. Like he was bucketed in a group as we were talking about guys with like Carson Williams of the Rays. There's a ton of strikeouts and power and all this. And then when
that is a terrifying strikeout rate. And I have him on my top 100 too. We're both in agreements, but that guy, that might be too much where where it's not a kill again. Like he's on my list. He's on your list, but it's, we got to pump the brakes.
The truth is there are lots of good big leaguers. Like Willy Adames has a three bat. He's a three bat, but he hits it for a ton of power and he's an amazing defensive shortstop.
He plays shortstop. Yeah, it helps.
And so like I felt Carson Williams, I think has a 35 grade future hit tool projection on my list, but it's six power and a six shortstop glove. And everyone loves him. Like the kid people seem to love. And he was a two-way player like 18 months ago. So maybe he's scratching the surface. And so, you know, like Miguel Blaise was in this group of guys talking through them and then through the data and talking to people on the phone. Mostly some of it is confirmation bias because it's people who I know are fine to be like, yes, stuff that effing guy. Do it. It's insane. And so, yeah, that's ultimately what led me to go like, look, fine. He belongs on either side of Tamar Johnson. This is about where a high school player this talented would go.
Yeah, and I know the batted ball data is excellent, right? That's why, to me, that's why Blaise is on the top 100 with very limited pro experience, super young, very wide range of outcomes, and some in-zone swing and miss. I mean, that's the thing, right? He's not chasing. You're correct. He's not making as much contact on stuff in the zone as you'd like to see. And, you know, I do worry that we get, this is not a criticism of you, obviously, but as an industry, we're a little caught up in some of that batted ball, you know, pitch by pitch data without fully understanding its predictive value. It's not to say it doesn't have it, because I'm sure it does, right? We want guys who hit the ball harder, or you end up overrating Xavier Edwards, like I did for a while. It's like, wait a minute, this guy just does not hit the ball hard, and maybe he never will. Which sucks, because I kind of like him as a player, but he is what he is. At some point, we have to just accept this is probably what it is. Unless he does. Did you see the CJ Abrams? CJ Abrams has put on 6 to 7 pounds this offseason. It was like, we're reporting single digit weight gain.
6 to 7 pounds?
6 to 7. He's like, that's good for me, which as somebody with a quick metabolism, I totally understand. That's maybe not a headline to me. I don't know.
Eric Longenhagen returns from cruise having added 6 to 7 pounds.
Yes. Well, that's the other thing, right? I do that every Christmas. What are you talking about?
Right.
Actually, I'm more likely to do it during spring training because that's where I really eat.
Funny cake connoisseur, Eric Longenhagen.
The
has added 6 to 7 pounds.
Yes, I'm gonna put that. we need some kind of bot to auto generate very, very trivial spring training health updates. and just one to just close the book on Blaise too. A year from now, obviously, your ranking, you're expecting him to, he's got to go to low A because we don't have short season. You're expecting him to go up and do some great things, right? It does. We don't have to talk specifically about the stat line, but he's going to do enough, say, on balls in play, too, to justify us putting him on the top 100, you ranking him high. Is there not a worst case scenario, because obviously these guys could all go there, strike out 40% of the time, and it's what the heck.
Right.
But is there sort of a middling scenario so that Red Sox fans who are listening, who are, you know, don't get disappointed if Blaise doesn't hit 25 homers in A ball this year? What would you consider sort of a we're on the right track kind of season for him that isn't a breakout season, but is obviously not any kind of, oh, we got to back off, pump the brakes a little bit on the hype?
That's a good question. Yeah, like I do kind of think that this, if anyone has a chance to just be Jackson Churio, that this is the guy. Mm-hmm. And I think like the sheer opportunity that he has to do that, like the fact that that outcome exists at all is a separator. But yeah, I guess what does it look like? It's probably him just going to low A, maintaining a strikeout rate in the mid 20%. I want to see the walk rate come up to something that is more emblematic of what I'm seeing in the Chase data, which is like closer to average in the 8% range, 9-10%, which even at low A, where guys don't really throw strikes, would be on the a little south of what I would think is average for a high confidence prospect, but would be fine for this guy. And then, yeah, I want to see him have like a 140 WRC plus as a teenager in full season ball, you know, something plus or minus, you know, 10 adjusted runs created, like somewhere in there. I think that would be, that's him just sort of sitting there. And then what I think might happen is if he does that for 2 months and then he goes to high A and he does that the back half of the season and he's 19 doing that at high A, you know, is he basically Jackson Churio at that point? Like, I think some of the Churio stuff, Churio at one point for me was like fourth, and then just he and Ellie fell because of confidence or lack of confidence in their hit tools sustaining. You know what I mean? So like, I think it's arguably more concerning that Ellie De La Cruz is punching out 33% clip at the upper levels while he's on a 40-man roster now, than Miguel Blaze doing it, yeah, like in the mid 20th percentile on the complex as an 18-year-old. So, but yeah, I think that, yeah, my aim is definitely, and I'm removed enough from some of the online hype and the zeitgeist of what that does. Well, that I don't realize that I'm creating like an expectation, you know, like I'm aware that the photon of light behaves differently when it's being measured, right? And observed. And so to like shine the spotlight on a guy like this may, not that like Fangraphs prospect list is going to do that, but the way now that percolates through the internet compounds in a way that I can't control and don't want to see happen.
No, that is not our purpose, right? I have said, had agents say things to me, like particularly about the draft. I'm like, I can't control that. And a big part of life in general is accept the things you can't control. But I also would rather not know. Like, I am not trying to impact anyone's career, especially adversely. I mean, here at least it could be a positive if we spotlight a player and get him more opportunities, or other teams look at him more, a player we like in the draft gets drafted a little higher. That's fine. But I don't want to ever be affecting anyone adversely. If that is an inevitable consequence of the work that you and I do, we can't control that. But maybe don't tell
me. Yes. I mean, I can dial up and down aspects of it, right? Like, I can choose to go back on my Twitter and it would say like, here's, you know, Miguel Blaze video and do whatever, right? Like, and say like, everyone look at this, but that I don't know what the long-term impacts of that are. Like the young men who are also on social media, like I look at Kevin Durant and I go like, oh, we didn't, you know, that sucks that this is like a sullen guy because he grew up in this era where like his expectations were just, he's scrolling through them, what people are saying about him. That's gotta be weird. And yeah, I definitely have like sensitivity to that now, which is part of why I've like left that space. But at some point I do have to say, this is where I value this guy. And we've been wrong about guys like this before. Marco Luciano is now like close to 100 on my list, right?
Yeah, you had him way down.
Yeah. And that he was just this guy for me at one point.
Yeah.
And he's
me too. I'm holding on hope more than you are.
But yeah, like he held serve, like he basically did after he started to get the hype, quote unquote, that was like, all right, good, he's doing it. And only now, like watching him and his, you know, back injuries and all this other stuff just happens, entropy happens, and you know, his body is hurt. And now I don't know what to do. He's got a stress fracture in his back that's been barking at him for over a year. What do you do? Like, so.
Yep.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So let me pivot back to something you said a moment ago. We actually got a couple injury guys to talk about too, but the highest guy on my top 100 who is not on yours, I believe, is George Valera from Cleveland. I have a pretty good guess why he wasn't on your list, but you know, he's 27th on mine. Obviously I'm betting big time on the upside. What is it that you, I feel like I should write it and put it, seal it in an envelope, what I think you're going to say. But go ahead. Tell me, where is your concern on Valera? Because you've seen him a bunch too. I know you see the upside. That's not what we're talking about. I'm going to guess this is related to probability.
Yeah, I don't think that he will hit enough to be what I think is like a 50, the type of player who I want to put on the 100. There are certain guys who, even though they perform, you can see elements of their swing that are going to be a problem against big league pitching, whether that's like JJ Bladé, Austin Wells is a guy like that for me now. And Valera is one of those where I just think that there are ways to beat him in the zone that big league pitchers do. They just do the thing that he is going to have a hard time doing, which is getting on top of those high fastballs. He's just so, you know, long and underneath the baseball. And when he connects, it's gorgeous. You know, he does have that Robbie Cano type of cut. But what he doesn't have that, like Cano did, is that ability to like shorten up, hit that up and away fastball to left field into the gap. And then, you know, that's one of my 40 doubles. That's not what this guy does. So I do think that there's a flimsiness to the hit tool that concerned me. The on-base component pushes and pulls against that for me. Like I totally see why you have him in there, because it's a left-handed bat who walks a ton and gets to power. Like when he's making contact, he's getting to huge power. And so, yeah, like I have him evaluated as the larger half of a platoon, but I do think that he's limited enough that he's a tier below the guys who I put in my 100.
Perfectly fair. I have no notes on this. And I mean, it's exactly where we disagree, right? And that's fine. I don't share the concerns about the ability to manipulate the bat. I have some concerns about generally in zone miss, and is some of that more in his eye and recognition rather than in the shape. But that to me, that is just a classic sort of subjective, a scouting thing. I did also lean on that one. I've seen Valera. A couple of scouts I talked to who were kind of all in were pushing me to put him over Rocchio, which to me, that's a no. That's Rocchio, is because Rocchio has floor and ceiling for me. I mean, that guy's, I'll be shocked if Rocchio doesn't just turn into at least a solid regular, but I think he's got a chance to be quite a bit more. Especially, I've always given Rocchio a little extra because he, you know, had the lost year in 2020 where he couldn't even get out of Venezuela. So developmentally, right, he's a little bit behind even his peers in the system.
Sure. Yeah. Rocchio is one of those where I was in the weeds because he played in the Venezuelan Winter League, and so I put on all that video.
Yeah.
And he maybe has the yips.
Like, we'll see.
He's struggled to throw to first base over the winter. It's just one of those weird things. Sometimes guys go through it, but let's see how that looks.
I want to see that here, right? Yes.
Yes.
So let me jump to real quick, a couple of, let's say, guys who have played catcher where we had some difference. It's not huge differences, but I'm curious again, sort of where we differ. So I had Diego Cartaya 6th overall. You have him 28th. So you still like him, obviously.
Right.
You have Tyler Soderstrom 30th, just right behind Cartaya, whereas I have him 66th. And I will say, at least on Soderstrom, it's because to me, there's zero chance he catches. It's first base, and now that's just, for me, it's first base only, or DH or whatever, et cetera. Just a really high bar to clear with the bat. So, you know, where do we differ on Clark Tyea? Do you have positional concerns? And on Soderstrom, is that a situation where you are just all in on the hit tool, which I can completely understand?
Yeah, with Clark Tyea, there are people who don't think he's necessarily a catcher, which I kind of disagree with.
Okay. Obviously, I do too. I think he's definitely a catcher. Yeah. I like his defense a little better than Francisco Alvarez, who I think there's still a little I think he's a catcher too. But if you're talking about these two guys, which guy do you think is less likely to stay a catcher? Alvarez for me, by a little bit, but enough.
I think that's fair.
Okay.
Yeah, I could totally see how, you know, even with the proximity thing, like Alvarez is basically there.
Yes.
He's fighting for playing time with
yep.
Narvaez and Nito, right? So
yeah,
you know, sorry, AAA they said, but yeah, he's basically there.
I think he could hit now in the big leagues, Alvarez, and probably get to some power pretty quickly. And I just, you know, I always try to back off. I know we've both been doing this forever now. You don't want to get overexcited about he's going to do this right now in the big leagues. That's a guy I look at. Yeah, he's ready. I don't worry about him hitting in the big leagues.
Yeah. Maybe you're right. Like it is the difference between the two of them, and they both have monster arms, right? So even though there are things about both of what they're doing on defense that people are concerned about, that I'm concerned about specifically with Alvarez, like Alvarez is a barrel chested kind of stocky dude. He's kind of tightly wound in the lower half, which separates someone like Alejandro Kirk from him. Like Kirk is big, but he's spindly and loose. And Francisco Alvarez does really swing super duper hard in a way that I could see scaring some people. I tend to take the under a little bit on what catchers are going to do offensively overall, just because of the grind, how much of a beating they end up taking that back there. Diego Cartaya played in about 90 games in 2022. He caught 60 games, right? So roughly half of what he would be expected to catch as an everyday big leaguer. And I do think that, like, you know, offensive performance tends to dilute for these guys, and also that over the course of like their trek toward the big leagues, that they're just taking a beating all the time, that creates some of this natural, you know, variance. Basically, the guys who break late tend to be guys who are built like Diego Cartaya, like Tyler Flowers. He's performing, and then he gets to the big leagues and it takes a while. And Travis d'Arnaud, and some of d'Arnaud is injury, but it's like he's awesome.
He's a catcher, he's right? That also happens to catchers. It's absolutely fair to factor that in.
So just in terms of, like, you know, the guys who are right there in my 55s compared to someone who has, you know, there may be more obstacles here, but for sure on upside, and I could see it as you apples to apples him with Alvarez, like I totally get that and could probably have been talked into that now retroactively. Like, which of these two guys do you really think has a better chance of staying back there? They both have hit tool risk, don't they? You know, so their defensive components are pretty similar. You could argue that Cartaya has more time to remedy that stuff because he's younger. Alvarez, maybe some of the stuff on defense won't ever get better. He's, you know, so so yeah, pretty interesting.
Couple of guys who pair of guys in particular, and actually I'll take that back, let me put all three in here. Three guys who were on your list who are not on mine, and who I think all have some similarities. Kobe Mayo, 36, I think on your list, I think's the highest guy on your list who is not on mine. Spencer Steer at 47 on your list, not on mine. Addison Barger, 53, not on mine. Now, in the case, I'll just say, of the latter two, I lean more towards utility infielder, multi-position. Barger has some platoon concerns. Mayo, it's a little less of that. I'm not sure he's a third baseman, and I do question. I mean, that is a very, very large man, and yeah. I saw the swing get long on him. I may be biased in the wrong direction by seeing him a little bit too much. Fully acknowledge that. I see a ton of the Orioles system, but any or all of those three, you'd like to talk about sort of where you why you are buying. Obviously, you do believe in all three of those guys as future regulars, given you've ranked them all in your top 60.
Yeah. So Steer, it's just confidence in the hit power combo. That was it. Like, for sure, second and third base for me. There are guys who I think move around who I value in this range for sure, even though they're not like the everyday second baseman and or whatever. Barger, it's just rare lefty bat speed, kind of under a bushel. He had a drug suspension a couple years ago. I don't know for what, like, could have been as benign as we like, I don't know. He had a drug suspension. So missed most of 2 years between that and the pandemic. And then the Blue Jays just sent him back to low A. They didn't say, you missed time. You're 21. Let's, accelerate this a little bit. They just were like, go to low A. And so then he was under my radar there as like, yeah, he performed, but he's old. Then explodes in 2022 on paper, comes to the fall league. It's just rare lefty bat speed for a guy who I think can actually stay on the dirt. Not a shortstop, but
probably no, I've seen him there. I definitely not a shortstop. I thought he was perfectly fine in third base.
Yeah. Second and third, fine. Obviously, Toronto has a third baseman. Santiago Espinal is great and like a luxury utility guy for them. And so Barger's like going to get reps in left, and maybe he'll play some combination of second and left. I do think he's better than Kevin Biggio. I think he fits in a nice platoon with like Merrifield at second base, left field, mix and matching. But ultimately, and this was one that like Tess was pretty adamant about, Tess Taruskin, who is a contributor at Fangraphs, who does prospect stuff with me. She has conviction around this guy. She came down the fall league and we spent time with this team and Mesa, and she's in on this guy. And so the Zips projections for Barger also have him close to 50th. And so that was reinforcing, but ultimately, all the components were there. Performed, it was like a 140 WRC plus in the mid minors, and he's 22 and is now 23 in that area. The bat speed like from the left side is pretty good. So we're in on that guy. And then Mayo, that's me. That one was all me. He has hit and hit for power since high school. His swing is weird and ugly and Hunter Pence-y in a way. It has never impacted the amount of contact he makes. I have him projected in right field. And this is one of those things.
I kind of like, do too, actually. Yeah.
Part of the reason I'm off of there now is like, I had this guy projected in right field from the jump, like since high school, been watching him take infield, and it's just like,
good job.
Oh no, I see the right. I know the arm strength is there, but the other stuff, sometimes he'll wow you, but the mobility is a real issue over there. But I have him projected in right field athletically. And yeah, like all of a sudden it's like this guy, like he's playing shortstop. Like what, this idiot doesn't even know what position he plays. Mm-hmm. So frustrated with that stuff. And like, still, this guy's playing third base, he projects in right field. I just think that there's so much power still to come because he is so big that once he moves to right field, that part of it might really take off. And even though his swing is dumb looking, it's always worked for him. And he was
a dumb looking swing. I love it.
In his write up, I describe his leg kick. It's an innie. Like he actually finishes, his legs finish. They finish closer together.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a reverse leg kick. Yeah.
It's so a reverse weird. Stride.
Yep.
But he just hits the piss out of it, Keith. And so I'm all in. Like, you can see he's sort of the back of that 55 group, right? Like the guys who, like Colson Montgomery, too, it's a corner, but the body's still so projectable. The field hit appears there. And the ceiling on the power, I think, has like, it's bigger than. I'm doing like frame and athleticism based projection, right? Like Kobe Mayo's already got this power and he's built like a tight end. So yeah, like that's me being out on my skis a little bit with my hubris and just going like, wow, this is a separator for me. And there's a degree of confidence there that that buoys where I have him as well.
The only thing I'll add is for me, Mayo is the highest ceiling of those guys easily on age, on power upside. And, I know he hasn't necessarily shown all the game power people anticipate. I think it's going to get there. I do think he can't stay at third for me. It is not only is he really tall for the infield, but some guys make that work. He doesn't move at all like an infielder. And, you know, try him in right field. He's got the arm. Try him in right field before you move into first base. He's still got the upside. Whereas the other guys, I have Steer is more, I question how much that power is really going to translate to the majors, although obviously Red's great home ballpark for power. And Barger, I think, is going to have some platoon issues that might make him better served. As you said, actually, the way you described using him, I think makes a ton of sense. Make him the strong half of the platoon. I think he could be really good that way. One more guy I wanted to mention. This was the difference in timing, really, is I'm assuming you dropped Danny Espino from Cleveland down to 93 on your list because we found out earlier this week he's got a pretty significant shoulder issue. And it's funny, he was relatively lower on my list. Actually, didn't write down where I have him on my list, but he was like in the 30s or so. And that was actually a reflection of, he was 33. This guy was a top 20, top 15 prospect going into last year. And really, on May 1st last year, looked like he was the best pitching prospect in baseball. So me saying he was at 33 was, I don't know if we really know how healthy this guy is. Then we find out he's broken. And I'm assuming that's why you dropped him to 93.
Yeah, actually, his injury caused a few dominoes to fall. I was one of those dudes who ran into Goodyear last spring to watch this guy like sit 98 to 102. And have Jake DeGrom's slider and land it consistently and, you know, vary the shape on his breaking ball and everything, basically, right? And he's kind of a freak. Espino has always been. He's built like an underwear model and he stretches four times a day and all this other stuff. And so I was all in and he was 12th on my list. Cleveland told me he was a full go for spring and I saw, you know, a video of him throwing and working out over the winter and was just prepared to leave him in the top 15 just because his freak factor is right there with Yuri Perez and Andrew Painter and the other guys who I valued up there. And so then, you know, the shoulder thing happens and this is what happens when the guys tumble from that top 25 area. It is almost always because of something like this. Brent Honeywell and AJ Puck and Forrest Whitley, like the snowball of injury starts to roll. And so, yeah, it becomes hard to, it's easy to evaluate Daniel Espino and love everything about what's happening. And it's hard to value him because of the injury stuff. So he ended up falling to the back of the 100 where there are also a bunch of injury risk guys with huge shit. So him, Mason Miller from the A's, Gavin Williams, you know, Gavin Williams, realizing that we wanted to clump some of these injury risk guys toward the back of the 100 made me move Gavin Williams up a half a tier from where he was on my Cleveland list from, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. Like when you really ballpark who belongs to the back of the 100, he probably belongs. And so, yeah, like those injury and relief risk guys at the back of the 100, DL Hall's already there and Wilmer Flores isn't built like a traditional starter. Now Espino sort of fits among that group.
Yeah, makes perfect sense.
Going to be hard for them to build an innings count there too, right?
Yes.
Like his 40-man clock's ticking. You only have so much time and so many options. It's going to be tough.
Yes, agreed. I mean, he would be probably off my 100 if I redid it right now because of the injury, because that's generally if a pitcher's got a significant shoulder injury. I think I've pretty much always taken those guys off the 100 in a, you know, if you want to criticize me for an excess conservatism on that, okay, sure. I will live with that. But the history of guys with shoulder injuries is obviously not good.
Right. It's Brendan McKay. It's, you know, like we start going through everyone who it is and it's like really scary.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So before I let you go, let's talk a little bit about this year's draft because the college season started this past weekend. I was in Arlington, Texas. I saw Braden Taylor, TCU, Enrique Bradfield Jr. at Vanderbilt, a couple of lower down guys. You saw Chase Dollander from Tennessee, a couple other guys. There were two tournaments going on out there, I think, in Arizona. You at least saw a bunch of schools. So what's jumped out at you so far? Particularly, do you think we've seen anybody, I'm thinking more college ranks at this point, make any kind of significant moves in either direction based on what came out of that first weekend, which I do think just because of primacy bias, right? First thing you see in the year, guys can make a lot of money just coming out very strong in that first weekend.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting because some of the team's behavior in the draft is definitely has recency bias, which makes sense because if players are improving and progressing, then of course they're going to look better over time. And then you have some of the other teams who have a take a like wider scope, and they're happy to take buy low opportunities on players who were good during their freshman and sophomore years, and then not so much as a junior. And I'm thinking about like Cleveland with Chase DeLauder and Shane Bieber had a down draft year. So it doesn't always work. Andrew Kalicka was conference player of the year as a sophomore at Santa Barbara, and then had a terrible junior year, and then Cleveland took him and he didn't do anything, right? So
right.
It's, you know, it's a mixed bag, but sometimes players do get better. I guess it's going to be pretty easy for people to apples to apples Wyatt Langford at Florida with Dylan Cruz at LSU towards the very, very top of the draft. And I could see how they come away after Cruz has basically held serve as the top guy in this class since he, you know, didn't sign in high school, right?
Like, yeah, took himself
he
out.
He was the guy. Right. He was a guy in high school where when he didn't sign, it was like, all right, well, 3 years from now, this is probably the best guy. He's the best unsigned high schooler. And he's held that for 3 years now. But now, like, Langford's tool set is pretty similar. And he's starting to encroach, I think, on Cruz. And I think he reinforced a little bit of that the first week of the year. I don't necessarily agree that that is how it should be, but it's certainly, I can see how people are thinking that.
Yeah, that's 1-2 for me. I haven't published a ranking yet because I, at this point, just because of the timing of what I do, I like to get a week or two of not just seeing sure. players, but also just talking to guys. It's like, let me just get into this a little bit more and I'll put up probably right. just a top 30 ranking. But the one thing I heard this weekend was, hey, this Langford, he should be in the 1-1 conversation. You know, spoke to somebody who said, I'd take him over Cruz, even with, you know, fully acknowledging what Cruz is, that Langford is pretty close as a hitter and probably a better overall athlete. But, you know, obviously this positional, you know, he's a left fielder in college. And I see that and I'm like, oh my God, is this Derek Fisher all over again? Where you're a 7-runner and a 3 defender? Like, how is that possible?
Man. Yes.
Right? It's scary.
That's right. Derek Fisher.
Yeah. God, we both saw him. Do we see him together? That might even be possible,
yes,
right?
We did.
That
being that's the new, day
yeah,
we
I
met.
Thought so. I think it is, yep. right? That's obviously that's why that came to me. And it's like that guy, I mean, he could have been hit on the head with a ball just standing in left field. I just never understood. It's yeah. like you're the best athlete on the team. What is happening here?
So yeah, Langford's definitely in that area. The feel in left field is not good.
As not good.
I published no. a pre-draft ranking. Folks can, you know, go to the site and find it. Just hover over yep. prospects, click on the board, and then once you get to that next page, click on MLB draft, and there they are. Langford's mm-hmm. 3 for me entering mm-hmm. the year. I have Braden Taylor from TCU ahead of him still, just because give me the lefty stick who stays on the dirt.
Yep.
There's definitely not as much juice there with Taylor as there is with Langford. I just like the blend of the contact and the power and like, yeah. You know, I do think that whole LSU team is they're rock stars, right? Like, LSU baseball is as close to a high pro, like a nationally known program in college baseball as there is. They've got a ton of, they've taken advantage of the transfer portal. They hired the coach away from U of A who took them to the College World Series. And he brought a bunch of players with him. Jacob Berry was a high pick last year. And they have a bunch of guys again this year. I think some of the guys who I've noticed have done something that makes me want to buoy them. It's not like at the very top of the draft, I guess, but there are some, you know, interesting early flags up. So like ASU's Saturday guy, his name is Christian Curtis with a KH. He's a KH Christian Curtis.
Isn't that like this guy's transferred heresy or something?
I don't know.
I'm an ex-Catholic, so what do I know?
What the transfer portal is such a huge variable now. So this guy was at A&M. He only pitched 5 games ever for A&M. He had a Tommy John that maybe wasn't well performed, maybe allegedly. I know you guys have that BetMGM money, but allegedly, just in case. And then So now, you know, last year with A&M, he was like 90-92. His first pitch on Saturday was 96. He's 6'5", 210. Like, it looks right, you know. So let's see how that develops over the course of the spring. It's one outing, right, where he was humming 93 to 96, basically, with a 90-mile-an-hour cutter and, like, changeup feel. He's good. He's a prospect who's draft eligible this year, whose name I didn't know until I sat down at Phoenix Muni on Saturday. So there's that. Trey Morgan with LSU, who is like the Eric Hosmer of college baseball, where it's like super slick glove, team leader type guy, you know, roundup guy in the clubhouse, raw powers there, but the swing has never produced that type of power in game. His swing looks different to me, and I haven't seen enough of it to like articulate what the changes are, but I do think that he has made a change that maybe has him on playing for impact a little bit sooner, like through a little bit more of the zone. So let's see how that one shakes out too. Those are the two guys. And then like all of Tennessee's arms, you know, Chase Burns for next year and Drew Beam and like Zach Joyce, and you know, they all throw hard and got their prospects for sure. And there are guys like that. But then I have some round down guys and this and that. But yeah, I saw Grand Canyon, I saw Jacob Wilson, I saw Tennessee, I saw Michigan State and Mitch Jeb, their little shortstop who can really hit lefty stick, you know, spray, kind of got that Eddie Rosario swing going on. Not as much juice as Rosario, but that bucket striding still gets extended and can flay those outer third pitches the other way type of middle infielder. Like it's cute and he can really hit, and yeah, a bunch of guys, but it's too early for me to be like, yeah, this guy's, you know, like what you did with Henry Davis, where you're like, you know what? This guy's probably going to go in the top three, right? At some point you have that sense, and no one has tipped into that. Like my intuition is not tipped into that yet. Some of that is prospect league too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I saw Braden Taylor, like I said, and yeah, you got him. It's not huge power. It's hard enough contact. It's a good swing. It's a good body. I questioned some of the instincts. Like he made some plays at third. It was not athleticism, but he was just like wrong place or trying to go after plays that should be the shortstops. But I also think that's something that you can more easily work on, as opposed to making a guy a better athlete or even like improving a guy's footwork, which can be done, but requires more effort. It was interesting to contrast Taylor to Enrique Bradfield Jr. at Vanderbilt, who's I think probably the fastest guy in the college class this year. I mean, I've gotten 80 run times on him before, but you know, first of all, he was trying to bunt on the first pitch the majority of the plate appearances I saw, which is idiocy. But you know, now this is draft year, and we bear down on guys a lot more. And I spent more time looking at his swing and thought, you know, it's kind of a mess, actually. It's not even a strength issue, although obviously he's kind of thin. But physically, it reminded me a little bit of, hey, a lot of us dinged Trey Turner as an amateur, thinking he's not going to be strong enough, he's not going to get to power. And it's, you know, it's an 80 runner, but is he going to hold up physically? Like, I'm setting that aside. Bradfield can probably put on some strength. But the swing has so many moving parts, so many things that seem to work against making better quality contact. And because they're both left-handed hitters, so it's very easy for me to watch and then go back to video and compare. It's like Taylor's is just simple, clean, direct. You shouldn't have to do a lot with it.
Right.
Whereas Bradfield, there's a lot of work to do. And I don't think it's like Jaren Kendall, where that was just a complete disaster. But it's, hey, here's another Vanderbilt guy with worlds of talent, where the team that drafts him is going to have to be ready to, all right, we need to improve the efficiency of your everything from your stride to the way your hands move to the way your hips move. That it is a lot of things that have to happen. I still think Bradfield goes in the first round because there's so much upside. Sure. But one of the beauties of these early season tournaments is you get to see two guys like that at the same time and can compare and contrast so much more easily.
Yeah, I think, and I like Enrique Bradfield a lot. There was a point at the end of last season when he was kind of banging him, like he hit one home run to the left of, you know, the batter's eye. And then when you look at where the parts of the zone that contact is happening, it is in a pretty limited spot at the top of the zone where he can, like, he kind of like alters his posture, and his bottom hand can really drive like that sweeping full effort swing through the top of the zone. But anything in the bottom half of the zone, he's chopping at and like spraying and slicing. And he has the speed that, you know, he can just be like Luis Castillo or someone like that, where he's still, he's like a 1984 leadoff hitter type of guy. And I like that player enough that that guy still goes in the middle of the first round for me. That's what we were hoping Sal Frelich would be when he was in the draft. Body types are different. Like Frelich's more compact and this and that, and like had multi-sport background. And there were other things about the profile that were different, but it was, boy, there's this guy makes plenty of contact. It's light, but I feel good about him playing up the middle. And that guy probably still goes in the middle of the first round. And if it turns out that he has a 7-hit tool or whatever, then he's just a really good player. And if not, then he's still probably, it's, you know, a fourth outfielder. But again, like that's a good player. That's someone who's like a cog in your mix. That's someone who the Rays or the Guardians or, you know, some of the teams that like to Voltron together 3-win players by virtue of having like a Manny Margot and a Josh Lowe together. You know, Enrique Bradfield still plays that type of role for a team like that. And that's still a damn good player.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I still, like I said, I still think he goes in the first round. I just think I probably, you know, rate him slightly lower than I did because I saw him at Arkansas last May and I saw one of his home runs, not the other way, but it was like, wow, he got some juice into that. There's a little more strength here maybe than I anticipated, but there are other things going on. And that's what happens, like I said, when we start to bear down on these guys. My guest today has been Eric Longenhagen of Fangraphs. I encourage you to go to Fangraphs where you can see his ranking of the top 100 prospects for 2023, which is a list that's almost as good as mine is. And you can also, as Eric said, hover over prospects and you can see his early ranking of players for this year's draft as well. And you could follow him on Twitter, but it sounds like you probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
Eric, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me again, buddy. And it feels good to be comfortable enough with our friendship that I can come on, do a Zoom call with you while I have like bedhead, 80 grade bedhead.
It is. I agree. It's good. Your hair is good enough. You could probably play for LSU.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Well, wait till you see me throw and you get the old 61. See you, Keith.
That's all for this week. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to keep up with my work, I'm still on Twitter at Keith Law. I'm also on Spoutable, Spoutible, also at Keith Law, and most of the usual sites as well. And as always, you can follow me in the Athletic app to keep up with everything that I'm writing. As we get deeper into the spring, there will be a lot more in-person work for me as I go to college games and eventually head to spring training with plans for me to go to Florida for a week and then also to Arizona for a week once the minor leaguers actually get underway. Thanks again for listening and stay safe.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.